Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 6th of November, these are our main stories. Several people have been stabbed in Jordan at one of its most popular tourist sites. A staunch critic of the Philippine president's war on drugs agrees to lead it. And they're off. The British Prime Minister has visited Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace, the official start of the general election campaign. Also in this podcast, Kashmir, 3 months on from the revocation of the Indian administered region's special status, and Stayin' Alive, the campaign to save the theatre, where the Bee Gees performed for the first time more than 50 years ago. But first, police in Jordan have arrested a man after several people were stabbed near Roman ruins in the northern city of Jerash. It's believed that some of the people caught up in the attack were tourists. Marco Junipero Serra from San Francisco witnessed the attack. He told us what he saw.
I was walking towards the center of the park and I saw a large group, like a tour group, together. And I saw a man dressed in all black and, you know, it wasn't a normal, you know, religious costume of any sort. It was something looked a little bit more menacing. Jumped the fence to get into the park. And immediately I started to see the people sort of, you know, move around quickly. And there was obviously a panic. And it looked like he was stabbing people because people were falling down onto the ground.
Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher told me more about the attack.
Well, we've had the Minister of Health in Jordan who's given a figure for the casualties. He's saying that 4 tourists were wounded and 4 Jordanians. The 4 tourists, the nationalities given, are 3 Mexican and 1 Swiss. The Mexican embassy has confirmed that the Mexicans were involved. I'm just seeing what Marco, the eyewitness you were just talking about, had messaged me earlier. I mean, quite graphic. He was saying that he walked with one of those who was wounded, a youngish girl who he thought was French, but it seems was actually Swiss. He says that she'd been stabbed in the side with what looked like a pretty thick knife, at least 2 inches across, and that she walked towards him for help. They walked together a bit, and then her boyfriend came and tried to staunch the bleeding. This all happened. I mean, Jerash is an absolutely huge site. There's a massive arch that you go through, and then the real entrance to the site is about 0.5 kilometre on from them as a cafeteria. We've been hearing from some other eyewitnesses, Jordanians, that it happened around the cafeteria, where obviously people, when they come out of the site, often go for refreshments. So it would be a natural place that you would go to if you were trying to attack tourists.
And so far, we know serious casualties, but no confirmation of deaths.
No confirmation of deaths, no indication that there are necessarily going to be deaths. I mean, the original information that we were getting from the Jordanians was that people had been lightly wounded. There have been some sources suggesting critically wounded, at least 2, but we haven't any update on that. I mean, looking, there have been 1 or 2 videos that have been put online and also the eyewitness statements. It does sound like, you know, people were stabbed and they were serious stabbing. So it will all depend on the loss of blood.
And this is very bad news for Jordan as a country.
It is. I mean, I was there just 2 or 3 weeks ago and I was actually quite surprised at how many tourists had come back. They'd actually gone because of all the trouble in the region, but Jerash was packed, Petra was packed. Tourism is absolutely essential for the Jordanian economy as a whole.
Sebastian Usher. In the Philippines, the president, Rodrigo Duterte, has appointed his main political rival as his new drug czar. The vice president, Lenny Robredo, will take up the role of tackling the ongoing problem of drugs in the country. Meanwhile, the UN is examining allegations that summary executions of suspected drugs traffickers have been carried out on the president's orders. I asked our Philippines correspondent, Howard Johnson, why Mr. Duterte has given his vice president that role, even though she criticised his policies.
Yeah, this all goes back to a spat that took place 2 weeks ago when Leni Robredo gave an interview to Reuters, the news agency, in which she said too many people being killed in this crackdown by the president. And she said that it was obviously not working. Now, he was annoyed by this. And so he turned around and said, well, you have a go. Let's see what you can do. And so he offered her the position. And over the last week, it was a case of will she or won't she? But today she came forward and said that she will take on this position because she said that the most important consideration for me was simple. If this is a chance for the killing of innocent to stop and to hold the perpetrators responsible, I will take this on. So she's very keen to address the issues with this drug war. Obviously, lots of allegations of extrajudicial killings, people being killed without due process. That's something that she would like to address.
So she is planning a new approach.
Yeah, Leni Robredo comes from the Liberal Party. She's a social activist by background, and she rose up through the ranks in the Philippines in 2012. Her husband died in a plane crash, and in the Philippines, that played very well with the electorate. They were very sad for her and supported her to the vice presidency position in 2016 in June. And what we've seen is that she's been a fierce critic of the president. She's always takes the side of the Liberal Party. That's a party that rose up against the martial law era here in the Philippines of the 70s and 80s, dictator Ferdinand Marcos. And interestingly, Leni Robredo has been fighting a battle with the son of Ferdinand Marcos, Bongbong Marcos, who challenged her for the vice presidency and lost. A recent report showed that actually she did very well in a recount and that challenge by Bongbong Marcos seems to have gone away at the moment. So she's going to be taking on this role as a drug czar next, and all eyes are on her to see if she can make a difference.
This has been one of President Duterte's signature policies. Is he really wanting change?
Well, let's not forget that he has stopped the drug war twice before. Once before when a Korean businessman was killed by the police, another time when a teenager was killed by the police who were later found to have killed him extrajudicially, the only prosecutions of police for EJKs during this drug war. So lots of people are warning Leni Robredo, this could be a trap. This could be a way of passing off the sins that have been alleged to have been committed by him to her, and that perhaps it might be a way of stopping the international pressure by showing that President Duterte is actually passing on or at least allowing some sort of internal look at his drug war to absolve him from the allegations that have been pinned against him.
Howard Johnson in Manila. Campaigning is underway here in Britain in what many fear could be one of the ugliest and most bruising election campaigns of recent history. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has been to see the Queen, and later he had this to say in Downing Street.
So it's been frankly mind-boggling in the last few weeks to see how Parliament first voted to approve this deal and then voted for delay. And I'm afraid that it is clear that if Parliament had its way, then this country would not be leaving even on January the 31st. And that, of course, is bad for democracy. It's disastrous for trust in politics. Why should MPs just decide that they can cancel the result of a referendum?
I asked our political correspondent Rob Watson what else has happened so far.
Apart from Mr. Johnson now officially launching the election 2019, we've had, and as far as I know, this has never happened before, a cabinet minister resigning over an issue. So it's not been an auspicious start for the Conservatives.
Is the cabinet minister resigning in the middle of an election campaign? We were just trying to discuss when this last happened in the newsroom.
I can't remember one, and it's not the only thing that's dogged the start of the election campaign for the Conservatives. Another minister, a prominent Brexiteer, Jacob Rees-Mogg, has been in trouble for saying something incredibly clumsy about the victims of Grenfell Tower that might have taken more common sense to ignore warnings from the fire brigade and leave the building. The Conservatives have also been found to have adopted a campaign video. They've sort of slightly adjusted the words of a senior Labour spokesman, so absolutely not an ideal start.
Despite all this, though, is Boris Johnson likely to secure the majority he needs to press ahead with his Brexit deal?
It's a cracking question, Alex, to which I have absolutely no idea what the answer is. I should, by the way, just in reference to that first question, say, you know, who knows whether that kind of stuff cuts through to the voters? I don't know. To answer the question you just answered, I think it depends on whether, you know, most of the people that voted Leave in 2016 come behind the Conservatives and whether they don't lose too many Remain voters to the other parties. I think that is the dynamic.
Rob Watson. An election campaign is also underway, but nearing its final stages in Spain. After an April ballot proved inconclusive, resulting in a six-month stalemate, parties are hoping that the election this Sunday will lead to the formation of a new government. However, Spain's fragmented politics could make that difficult. And with the country in the middle of a territorial crisis caused by separatists in Catalonia, politics has become extremely polarised, as Guy Hedgeco reports.
Tempers fray in a televised debate between the five candidates for Prime Minister. With no party able to form a government in the wake of a vote 6 months ago, this will be Spain's fourth general election in 4 years. On the streets of Madrid, voters seem to be getting fed up.
I don't trust any party, because I think that they are not really doing their job. They are not communicating with each other to make Spain a good country.
We are tired to have to go and vote again this weekend. The politicians don't seem to agree. They are making us go back to elections again. And I think they should reach an agreement soon, because this can't go on for too long.
Yeah, I think that I'm going to vote, but I'm really tired about this kind of situation, because always the politicians don't want to make the better with the others, and I think that is terrible for our economy and democracy, no?
Pedro Sánchez, the socialist acting prime minister, won the April election, and once again he's been ahead in polls, although again he is unlikely to win a majority. But there's a feeling that this time there's more at stake. Economy Minister Nadia Calviño says the country needs stability.
It is a very important election. It is very important that next Sunday the Spanish people are clear on their preferences, and I hope that they will massively support the Socialist Party so that we can, as of November the 11th, start to have a strong, stable government with a four-year prospect in order to face the important challenges ahead, both in terms of the slowdown of the international economy, in terms of the putting the Catalan conflict on a positive track.
That Catalan conflict has dominated Spanish politics for some time. In recent weeks, it has got worse, after nine Catalan leaders were sentenced to lengthy prison terms for their role in a failed bid for independence 2 years ago. Since then, pro-independence Catalans have been taking to the streets to protest, with a small minority taking part in violent incidents. The political right has sought to portray Mr. Sanchez as weak on the Catalan issue. Cayetana Álvarez de Toledo, of the main opposition Popular Party, says the parliamentary support he received from Catalan nationalists last year to become prime minister means he is too tolerant of them.
The acting prime minister is prime minister because of his political pacts with the forces who are now burning the streets of Barcelona. Spanish socialism needs to stop its reactionary drift towards alliances with nationalists. That is crucial for Spain, crucial for Europe. It's crucial for coexistence in Spain and beyond.
The government denies making any such pact with Catalan nationalists. But the arrival of several new parties in recent years, here behind me in Spain's Congress, has fragmented the country's politics and made it more polarised than before, as Podemos on the left, Ciudadanos on the right, and also the far-right Vox, which has been surging in polls recently. Not only does that make the solving of the Catalan conundrum difficult, it also means that for whoever wins Sunday's election, forming a government is going to be a huge challenge.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. Still to come in this podcast, a victory for women's sport in Australia. The national women's football team, the Matildas, will get the same money, perks and entitlements as the men's team.
This new deal is enormous. As a female footballer, it's kind of what we've always dreamed of. We've always wanted to be treated equal. We wanted to be able to step out on that pitch with equal opportunity and the equal facilities that the men have been exposed to.
It's been 3 months since Indian-administered Kashmir's special status was revoked by the Indian government. Violence in the region has been growing ever since, and officials say that it's being carried out by armed insurgents to prevent Kashmir from going back to normal. There have been targeted attacks against migrant workers, and Kashmiris continue to live in fear and uncertainty. Yogita Limoye reports from Kashmir.
Dozens were rushed into one of Srinagar's main hospitals. They were injured in a grenade attack. Officials say it was the worst such incident since India revoked Kashmir's special status. The bomb went off in a street market in the heart of Srinagar. One person died. He was a migrant worker. Police say armed insurgents are behind these targeted attacks on migrants. But no militant group has so far claimed responsibility. Many of those killed were drivers of trucks that had come into Kashmir to receive consignments of apples. Yasin Chaudhary, one of South Kashmir's top bureaucrats, says the motive is to disrupt business.
See, obviously, this is an attempt by militants to sabotage the ongoing apple trade, because this is obviously the mainstay of our local economy. And the idea is to clearly create an atmosphere of fear in the minds of growers, traders, drivers alike, and make sure that people sustain losses as much as possible.
Now, on the road, I've just passed a big fruit market that is entirely empty. And I've come to a small warehouse where apples are being packed. In front of me, workers are sitting on the ground. They're putting hay first into cardboard and wooden boxes and then dropping in the apples. The long period of shutdown, the communication blockade, and now this recent spike in violence has meant that this trade has been hit very hard.
Most of Kashmir's businesses remain closed. It is partly because of the fear of militant groups, but for many in the region, it's also their way of showing their protest against the Indian government's actions. To prevent this public anger from erupting into violence, tens of thousands of extra troops remain deployed on the ground. And Kashmir's own political leaders have been locked up. A hotel on the banks of Srinagar's famous Dal Lake has been converted into a detention centre. Arif Amin is a young member of PDP, one of Kashmir's main political parties.
Our leaders have been humiliated and kept locked up for no reason. In Kashmir, it's local politicians who have always prevented people from engaging in protests and violence. Now, who will give direction to the public? People could turn to separatism or militancy.
For decades now, many in Kashmir have opposed Indian rule in the region and supported insurgents. In southern Kashmir, I met a man who has two sons that joined militant groups. We're not naming him because he fears reprisal from the government. I asked him how he can justify the violence carried out by these groups. If India was willing to talk to us and listen to our voice, there would have been no need to pick up the gun, he says. They've compelled our boys to fight this battle. The government in Delhi says its move will bring peace and development to Kashmir. On the ground, there lingers a haze of anger and confusion.
Yogita Limoye reporting from Srinagar. It's being seen as a landmark deal for women's sport and the issue of equal pay. In Australia, the national women's team, the Matildas, will earn the same money as the male team, the Socceroos. They'll also receive the same perks and entitlement. At a news conference, one of the Matildas' star players, Elise Calland-Knight, said this new collective bargaining agreement was a major step forward for women.
This new deal is enormous. As a female footballer, it's kind of what we've always dreamed of. We've always wanted to be treated equal. We wanted to be able to step out on that pitch with equal opportunity and the equal facilities that the men have been exposed to. So I think as a player, the new CBA shows signs of respect. Now we're going to be completely included. and also opportunity. I think having these facilities that the men have been exposed to is now going to set us up for success.
For more on the story, I spoke to our Sydney correspondent, Phil Mercer.
Well, this is a new four-year deal, Alex. It means that the Socceroos, which is Australia's male national team, and the Matildas, which are the women, will receive a 24% share of national team-generated revenues. They'll earn equal pay and entitlements on many key measures. That proportion will increase by 1% each year, and it has been very enthusiastically received by the football fraternity in Australia. Players of both the male and female sides saying that this is a very big moment. And one of the Matildas star was saying that for many of the female players in Australia, this is a life-changing deal.
This phrase, on many key measures, what does that mean?
Well, this means that off-field benefits that the Socceroos, the Australian male international team, has received for many, many years will now be offered to their female counterparts. This includes things, Alex, such as business class flights, training facilities of the highest level, and also specialist support staff. So whatever the men get, the women will now get too. For example, during a recent World Cup campaign, the Australian team, as is usually the case, has to do a lot of travel in between international games. One of those matches ended up with a very long flight and players being offered massages and physiotherapists on a specially chartered aircraft. It's those types of benefits that will now be offered to the women's team, the Matildas. So it's not just about pay, it's about other conditions of work as well.
Is there a difference in popularity between the men's game and the female game? Because I know the women are ranked much higher in the world.
Well, there is a big difference. The Matildas are currently ranked 8th in the world, while Australia's men's side, the Socceroos, come in at 44th. When you see how popular football has become here in Australia in recent times, it's girls and boys playing the round ball game. And you have to remember that in Australia, the sporting landscape is extremely busy. Cricket is ostensibly the national sport, and rugby league, rugby union, Australian rules football, very popular, as are netball and swimming and tennis. Australia is a sports mad nation, and ever so slowly, football is gaining in popularity at a participation level. It is one of the most popular sports in the country, and that's why the governing body, Football Federation Australia, or one of the reasons why it is moving to make sure that men and women are on an equal footing when it comes to pay. There will still be discrepancies. FIFA's prize money for the World Cup, it still pays men and women different for the various World Cups that they compete in. So there will still be an international pay discrepancy, but Football Federation Australia says that it's working very closely to try to make sure that those discrepancies, those differences in pay, are as minimal as possible, and that's why it's outlined this new pay scale today.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. In the city of Manchester, here in England, fans of the disco group the Bee Gees are trying to save the theatre where the band performed for the first time more than 50 years ago. And they don't have much time to do it, as Peter Goffin reports.
In the late 1970s, the Bee Gees were as much a part of the disco scene as flared trousers and light-up dance floors. But when the Gibb brothers first broke into show business, they had a very different sound. In 1957, still in primary school and calling themselves the Rattlesnakes, the Gibbs performed in public for the very first time at a venue called the Gaumont. The building, now nearly 100 years old and long since turned into a funeral parlor, is still a site of pilgrimage for Bee Gees fans. And with developers planning to tear the place down and build a block of flats, a local residents' group is trying to preserve this piece of Manchester music history. They want to turn the site into a community space featuring a food market and a live music venue, a lasting tribute to the Gibbs brothers. To do it, they'll need to raise more than $300,000 by Saturday. And they've launched a crowdfunding effort so fans can chip in. The name of that campaign? Staying Alive.
The rather deeper voice of Peter Goffin ending that report on the Bee Gees. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address, as always, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.